This weekend, the town of Bath, Illinois, wages its annual war against the invasive Asian carp with its redneck fishing tournament.
These fish are dangerous. They come up and hit a little one in the head, they could kill them. So we decide this is on. This is the revenge of the fish. We're out after them.
That's organizer Betty DeFord talking to the National Geographic Channel about the tournament she started 11 years ago. She joins us. We'll also talk about the reintroduction of the prehistoric alligator garfish into our waterways. Also, Illinois researchers are using nanomedicine to help better target cancer and hopefully reduce the side effects of treatments like chemotherapy. We talked to the organizer behind this weekend's Punk Black Sheep Fest in Springfield and a look at the state house campaigns leading up to this November's election. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Central Illinois Dogs are helping local nanoscience researchers who are working on treatments around cancer drug delivery. Nanomedicine, as you might guess, is a combination of nanotechnology and medicine. The goal is to take a drug and get it delivered exactly where you want it to go in the body. This new study demonstrates that nanoparticles can be used to deliver cancer drugs straight to the tumors of dogs who have bone cancer. Dogs who already had cancer were recruited to be used in the study, and studio with me are two of the University of Illinois professors who led it. Dr. Tim Fan is an associate professor in the Department of Veterinary Clinical Medicine, and Jian Zheng Cheng is a professor of material science and engineering. Dr. Fan, Professor Cheng, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We should point out that there are dozens of nanopharmaceuticals that are approved for human use, but most nanomedical research studies are carried out in mice. Dr. Fan, why did you decide to do this study with dogs?
So I think that when we look at drug development, there are some very classic animal models that are included in that development path. Most often, they are using mice. What I try to research and try to promote is really comparative oncology. And so looking at diseases that are shared between people and companion animals. And we chose to evaluate this nanotechnology in pet dogs with cancer because the tumor type that we were studying is very, very similar biologically, genetically, as people that get this type of tumor. And importantly, there is a size scale effect. So when we evaluate novel therapies in mice, they're very small in body size.
And the tumors are probably very small.
Exactly. And the tumors are very small. And so in general, I think that you can get a greater effect in mice that often when you try to translate that to people, that effect is minimal or lost. And so we as comparative oncologists believe that using pet dogs with naturally occurring cancers that have tumors that are approximately the same size as the tumors that we see in people, that any effect that we see from a novel therapeutic may recapitulate that more accurately when that novel therapeutic is translated to human applications.
Professor Cheng, your role in the project and your lab's role was to create the actual nanoparticles that were used in the study. Why nanoparticles? Why is that important?
So using nanoparticle for drug delivery is quite important because typically the drug can be cleared from the circulation, from the blood circulation very rapidly within a couple of minutes to a few hours. Then using nanoparticles, then they can carry a large amount of drugs and also can circulate for longer time, so they have a better chance to find the target.
And is this the case of where when we're thinking about, for example, like chemotherapy, and oftentimes we see people have awful side effects, could nanomedicine, nanoparticle treatment, would that help eliminate some of those things?
So that's exactly the purpose for designing the nanomedicine. For example, a regular chemotherapeutic agent, it is very difficult to put a targeting ligand on the drug itself because the targeting ligand is going to overwhelm. There will be also the loading will be also very low. But when we use a nanomedicine, nanoparticles to delivery drug, then nanoparticle can carry a large amount of therapeutic agent within the nanostructures. And also we have a quite a large surface areas, so we can put the targeting ligand on the surface so they can carry the nanostructures to the specific target and then release the drug slowly and locally to treat the cancer with low side effects.
And Dr. Fan, targeting ligand, that's what takes the drug to where you want it to go?
Yes, I think that, you know, the whole strategy is to bring a drug or a therapeutic to a specific area. And you can target different things. You can target the tumor cells specifically based upon what they express on their surface. Specifically for our study, we were targeting the microenvironment or the environment that the tumor cells were growing in based upon the destruction of bone.
Professor Cheng, when we say nano, I think everyone knows that it's small, but how, when we say nanoparticles, do we have what size are these?
So nanoparticle typically means around less than 200 nanometers for the typically nanomedicine's diameters. So it's much thinner than the human hair, for example. The hair is about micron size, 20 micron size, while the nanoparticles will be one-tenth or even like even smaller than the diameter of the hair.
So
it's really tiny. You
right.
cannot see it.
Right.
But you can see it under the typical microscopes.
Yeah. And how big are, and Dr. Fan, how big are these tumors generally?
You know, I, for these pet dogs that we were studying, they're large dogs. This type of tumor develops in large dogs or giant breed dogs. So 80 to 150-pound dogs, and the bones that these dogs have are about comparable size as people. And so we're looking at tumors that are in the range of, you know, a plum or a lemon-sized type of tumor growing in bone.
And how many dogs were involved in the study?
We had 9 pet dogs that were actually included in the study.
How did you find these? How did you recruit the dogs?
So I think that there's great interest to develop novel therapies. And in companion animals for pets, there really isn't a lot of great therapies. And pet owners are very committed to trying to find new therapies that may help their pets. And so for our study, we did provide standard of care for the treatment of osteosarcoma, which is to remove that tumor. In addition to that, we tested these nanoparticles if they could actually get delivered to that primary tumor growing in bone. And so we had advertised across the state, as well as we have close working relationships with referring veterinarians in the area. And so often veterinarians that have clients that are seeking new therapies for their dogs with osteosarcoma, they will be referred to our clinic in Urbana.
Well, and I imagine that whatever existing treatments that might exist for that for dogs would probably be pretty expensive, too.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big differences when we look at animal health versus human health, right? So health insurance is a major subsidiary or supporter for human health, while animal insurance is not very common. So less than 5% of pet owners will have animal insurance, and therefore the costs of therapy are really out of pocket. And so pet owners that want to provide new therapies seek investigational trials like what we were offering.
That's Dr. Tim Fan. He's an associate professor in the Department of Veterinary Clinical Medicine. We're also speaking with Jianzheng Chen. He's a professor of material sciences and engineering, and we're talking about the research they did in nanoscience, nanomedicine for cancer treatment, and particularly for, as we're talking about, bone cancer with dogs. This was done at the University of Illinois. Dr. Fan, you said you took the tumors out of the dogs. Were you, when the dogs are in this trial and they're pet dogs, were you able to help the dogs?
So certainly the management of osteosarcoma is twofold. One is to remove that tumor because it's very painful. And number two is to provide systemic therapy, treatment with chemotherapy. And so I think that our study achieved both of those folds. One was that they did have their tumor removed as standard of care. And then secondly, they did receive systemic chemotherapy in the form of delivered nanomedicine. And so I think that we were able to provide both standard of care treatment options for these pet dogs.
Professor Chang, did you, as you're doing this research, I imagine it's probably really helpful to have the actual dogs. I don't know when you guys are building, and I don't even know what goes into building sort of the nanoparticle delivery system. How important is it to have, as Dr. Fan is saying, a subject like a dog that would be a similar size delivery for eventually if this could be used for humans?
Yes, as Dr. Fan mentioned earlier, so it is very important to use large animals to evaluate so that some of the information can be translated to human trials later. There are a lot of research being finished using the murine model, which is small animals like mice. Then often the information cannot be translated. For example, the mice have a very different vasculature systems. The nanoparticle may penetrate the tissues more efficiently in the mice tissues, but may not be in the human tissues. So the effect can be dramatically different. Even we see great effect of inhibiting tumor growth in small animals, but they may not be the case in the large animals or in the humans. So that's why it is very important to use dog and some large animals like dog to do the nanomedicine research.
Dr. Fan, I think that is it common for to do what you all have done, to use large animals as opposed to mice?
I think that there's a growing discipline that's being recognized in the scientific community, which is comparative oncology. And so there are certainly areas in research institutes that encompass veterinary colleges across the nation that collaborate and work with basic scientists to do these comparative studies. So I think that there are quite a few examples in which pet dogs with cancer are being included in investigational trials with novel agents.
Now, obviously, in this trial, you all were recruiting dogs who had developed cancer spontaneously. I think that people, when we're talking about animal research, this can be a really controversial topic. People can be very passionate about it. And I wanted to ask you, because I know the University of Illinois is actually in the middle of a lawsuit right now over animal research. There's a national animal rights group. They're called the Beagle Freedom Project, and they're suing because they want lab records from research studies on dogs to be made fully accessible to the public. Now, I know you can't comment directly on the lawsuit because it's ongoing, but I just wanted to ask, as a researcher, what you want people to know and understand about animal research and how it's conducted.
Sure. I think that it's very important to have the public educated on what is the process and what are the policies that go into animal research. It's a very rigorous, it's a very ethically driven process. We have standing committees that review animal protocols on a daily to monthly basis to ensure that there's ethical treatment of animals, whether they're beagles, whether they're cats, whether they're rodents or amphibians. And so, you know, the university...
Are the standards the same, whether it's a mouse or a dog?
It is. So I think that it's defined as really, you know, agricultural, non-agricultural animals and vertebrate species. So the standards are the same.
Is there an alternative? Do you think there is? Because I think there are probably people listening who, especially people who feel very passionately about this, who think, can't you do this another way?
So I think that that's an excellent point. Part of the Animal Care and Use Committee on the University of Illinois campus mandates investigators to do searches for alternative methods to evaluate their research hypothesis. And so there are ways that can be used to complement animal research, sometimes with computer simulations. But I think that we have to understand that the complexity of a living organism is impossible to quite honestly replicate with a computer. And so the need is to reduce the number of animals that need to be used for research. It does not eliminate them. And as investigators, we are always mandated to search for alternatives that do not use animals to supplement our research.
Professor Chang, is it possible to do the research that you're doing, particularly when you're talking about having a nanoparticle delivery system? It sounds like that it's important that that's tested physically. Is there a way to do it virtually?
Currently, there's no any other way to do it. So you have to really formulate the nanoparticle and then evaluate in a real systems. You know, as Professor Fan just mentioned, it is we don't have a very feasible technique to evaluate other than physically doing the research.
What challenges do you expect as you take the next step, Professor Chang, in testing out this on humans?
Well, testing the humans, there are many, many steps to go through. We demonstrate the efficacies or targeting efficiencies in animals, especially in large animals, which is a great step. Then translate for human trials of eventual clinical applications. Then you have to go through hurdles, and also they involve a lot of financial support, money, investment. So it's a very long process, but it's looks like we have a great system to get started.
Dr. Fan, Professor Chang said it's a long process. Is there a time frame for how soon you all can get to? This was obviously. What's the time frame for where you're at now with this was successful within these dogs that you studied? When could this get to a point of being tested for people?
So I think that it goes back to the level of investment and interest by companies that want to invest in this technology, because as Professor Chang has described, there are many barriers or hurdles that have to be overcome with preclinical testing, right?
So for people.
For people, mm-hmm. right? So to get some type of investigational new drug designation, you need to have a huge amassed amount of preclinical data. And we have scratched the surface of that with our study. I think that our findings are very promising and very exciting. And then this potentially could generate interest in further developing this type of technology for ultimate translation. But I think that's many, many years kind of in the future with all the right pieces in play.
Tim Fan is an associate professor at the Department of Veterinary Clinical Medicine at the University of Illinois with his colleague, Jianzheng Cheng, who's a professor of material science and engineering. We tweeted out the link to all of their research. If you follow us at 21st Show, you can read more about it. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. You can always connect with us on social media. Search for The 21st Show on Facebook to like us. You can see what our team's working on. You can comment and interact with us there. You can follow us on Twitter at 21st Show. That's 21st Show. We've been spending so much time focused on the national election, one might almost forget that come this fall, there are quite a few local and state races, and all 27 incumbent Democrats and 16 incumbent Republicans are campaigning for House seats in Illinois. Given the 71-seat super Democratic majority that currently exists in the House and that theoretical ability to overturn Republican Governor Rauner's vetoes, the results of these campaigns in the fall is sure to have an effect on the state legislature's relationship with Governor Rauner. Ivan Moreno is the Illinois State House Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. He's been writing about this and joins us on the line now from Springfield. Hey, Ivan, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you for having me again.
Let's talk about that 71-seat number. How important is that 71 seats, and how many races are there this fall where maybe that number might change?
Well, it's important because 71 is really a razor-thin supermajority. If one Democrat defects, they basically lose it, and that's happened on a few issues this past session where Democrats have tried to override vetoes from the governor, where they don't all stick together. They have one or two members who side with Republicans, and then Democrats have been unable to override those vetoes. So if they could get a little bit more of a cushion, maybe gain a few more seats, that'll give them some breathing room for when they want to override the governor on, you know, whether it's the budget or whether it's, pro-union legislation. As far as how many races we're looking at here that could swing either way to determine whether Democrats have more of a supermajority, as you mentioned, there's about more than 40 races total where incumbents are trying to seek re-election. And it's hard to say at this point how many of those will end up being competitive. A lot of those are in the Chicago suburbs where you have a mix of Democrats and Republicans. And a lot of other races are down south in the state where you have more of a mix of conservatives and Republicans as well, conservatives and Democrats as well. So at this point, it's hard to say. But one thing that we could count on is there's going to be millions millions of dollars going into these races.
Well, we've already seen that, right, Ivan, because we've seen whether it's House Speaker Michael Madigan or Governor Rauner, there's lots of money going into these races. Which ones are you paying the most attention to?
Well, Democrats are targeting this Republican incumbent, Representative McAuliffe, and that's going to be a race where he represents an area that's near O'Hare, and that's going to be a race where Democrats so far have not spent a lot of money yet. They have a candidate who's running there who is very pro-union, but so far, again, not a lot of money has gone into that race yet. But they see McAuliffe as sort of a vulnerable Republican. On the Republican side, Republicans are targeting a state representative from Kankakee, Representative Clunan, who won her re-election 2 years ago by a really small margin, like more than 100 votes. And in that case, Democrats have been supporting her with more than a half million, or actually around $700,000 so far. And on that side, you also see in that race where Republicans have not yet kicked in a lot of money, but we expect that to change. I mean, if the primary was any indication, some of these races are going to exceed millions of dollars. I mean, again, we have primaries where there was like more than 5 million. So,
wow. Ivan, do you expect August to be to be more of a focus on local politics? The national conventions are over. This is a time when legislators, lawmakers are traditionally back in their home districts. Do you think that August will be pretty quiet, or do you think that this will be a busier month because of the campaign?
I think things are really going to kick off. Traditionally, campaign season really starts in earnest on Memorial Day weekend. So
Labor
Day,
Memorial. You mean Labor Day?
Labor Day next month. Yeah, that's typically when you see it kind of as a marker for when these races really start to go full steam. So that's really when I'm expecting things to really start ramping up. You're right. It's going to be a mix of local politics, but also, each side is going to make it as, you know, Democrats want to make it a referendum against Rauner, and Rauner wants to make it a referendum against Democrats, and all of the issues that he's been trying to change now for his first term in office, like trying to enact term limits, changing the way legislative districts are drawn, and also, of course, trying to decide how to settle on a state budget.
Ivan Moreno is the Associated Press for Illinois State House Bureau Chief, joining us from Springfield. Hey, Ivan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Finding a way to stop the growing problem of Asian carp has been swimming through the minds of Illinois biologists for years. One town on the Illinois River is taking matters into their own hands. Betty DeFord is the founder of the Redneck Fishing Tournament. Since 2005, she's led fishermen on a weekend-long hunt to get rid of the invasive creatures. She's joining us on the phone now from her home in Bath, where the tournament is this weekend. Bath's about 50 miles northwest of Springfield on the Illinois River. Good morning, Betty. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Thank you.
How did this event first get started, Betty?
This event started several years back when my husband and myself and our 16-foot John boat and my daughter and a friend were just taking a little cruise down to Bath Chute, which is a 7-mile stretch, combines the Illinois River each direction, and we ran into a school of the silver Asian carp, and they about swamped our boat. We were beating them out with brooms and the boat oars, everything we had, hitting with our hands, and by the time we got out of there, we were bloodied and slimed from head to toe and had 32 fish left in the boat that were still throwing out. We thought we were going under. So it's called the Revenge of the Carp because we started this tournament and we thought, well, we get them out of there so we could take the grandkids out, you know, boat riding or fishing or whatever, and we were just going to get them out of there, and it just totally grew.
And Betty, I think it's hard for people to understand who haven't been through this experience, but you're describing it pretty well for people. There's two species of carp, and one of them actually jumps. And so when they hear your boat motors, what actually happens?
These silver ones are the ones that get very irritated with the boat motor, and they jump out of the water, and they can jump up to 10 to 12 foot high out of the water. I was actually driving a pontoon boat and had one come up, smack me in my shoulder and on my side of my face, and I was black and blue from this thing.
Oh, no. Now, how do you all, for this fishing tournament, then how are you catching them? So you're not actually using, there's no fishing poles involved here.
They don't bite on pole and line, but they jump out of the water. So you are allowed one handheld dip net per participant in the boat, and you try to catch as many of them as you possibly can in a two-hour heat.
What's the record? What's the record for who's caught the most?
I think that belonged to Randy Stockham, and I think they've caught 462.
462 carp?
Yes.
How did they even fit that on their boat?
They had to come in and dump, they take big barrels and put on the boat, so you have to allow for the weight of the fish plus the weight of the fishermen on your boat, so you're legal. They had to come in and make three trips in with the barrels to dump them and go back out in a two-hour period.
Because you have to be really careful with that weight. I mean, the boat might sink, right?
Yes, you sure do. You do. But it's a lot of fun, but we actually, that year, we don't go by pounds because there's no way we could with the fish, but we actually caught 10,600 fish in 4 two-hour heats, and I limit it to 50 boats per heat. So that is a heck of a lot of fish that the silver ones we took out of this
Right.
river.
And we should point out to people, it's illegal to throw Asian carp back into the water. So what do you do with these things once they're caught?
We have Schaefer Industries, the fish market from up north, comes and they bring a refrigerated truck and they put the, we park the truck down there and we load them into tubs up there. They take our fish for us and they make it into fertilizer.
Oh, they make it into fertilizer. Have you ever tasted Asian carp, Betty?
I sure have.
Is
and
it good?
If you'd like, it is good. And if you would like to, Saturday down at the event, which is this weekend in Bath, we have Clint Carter, and we have also have Chef Perello from Louisiana coming down. That is a well-known chef down there. They are going to be doing Asian carp samples of the fried, and they're also going to be doing like a fish gumbo from the chef that he makes different recipes. And the only, actually, they are good. The only thing, I'll be truthful with you, the only thing I couldn't get the taste in my mind is fish tacos. I'm sorry, but there's just something about tacos and fish that just doesn't mix with me. But
oh, so you don't like fish tacos. Okay. But what does it taste like? Is it kind of like, does Asian carp, is it kind of like tilapia or cod, or is it more sort of like kind of your more traditional kind of river whitefish? What does it taste like?
It's more of a traditional fish. It's good. It depends on how you batter it, what kind of battering you got, but fried, and it is good. It's good and it's tasty. And that's what we're trying to promote down here because we have so many in our river that you're not going to get out of it, rid of them. And this tournament, actually, of catching that many fish is making a small dent in it. We're bringing the awareness of the problem. But look how many hungry people we have in this world, how much foreign aid we sent over. Send these carp over there. That's you know, there's food here. That's what they eat. That's what they like to eat. And there you go. You know, help people by eating the darn things.
Betty, have you noticed a difference between when you first started doing this 10 years ago in terms of the volume of carp that you're seeing in the water in Bath?
Yes, there's more fish.
More carp.
They spawn between 3 and 4 times a year, and we have the ideal spawning place right down here on the Bath Chute.
Mm-hmm. And how many, and what's the, if someone wants to get involved with the tournament, what do they need to do?
They need to come to Bath, Illinois, come to the riverfront. Our heats are Friday and Saturday this week, noon to 2, 4 to 6 p.m. It's $50 to bring your boat down, make sure it's all legal, and bring one handheld dip net per participant. Come on down, get you signed up. You sign up 2 hours beforehand. So we start signing in people at 10 o'clock every morning, 2 o'clock every afternoon. Come on down, and we'll get you signed in, and you can go out there. You can even wear costumes because we have costume judging for that also.
Well, I have two more questions for you. With the costumes, is there protective headgear that you recommend people wear?
You can wear protective headgear. We have had broken noses and black eyes because when you're catching one of them, the relative jumps up and gets you from behind. You don't know they're coming.
Is there a prize for the person who catches the most Asian carp, Betty?
Yes, there is. We do prizes both days. We used to split it up. We do cash prizes for the first, second, third, fourth prize, and they also win trophies for the event. And I might add that the event that we have down here, after we have live bands, we have everything along with that. We even have a bags tournament on Saturday morning. Starts at 9 o'clock, check in between 8 and 9. And all the proceeds after the expenses goes to the Central Illinois Homeless Veterans.
Oh, so all of the proceeds go to a good cause, as you're saying, homeless veterans.
Yes, I started that 3 years ago. My husband went to Danville 3 years ago and for a program for a couple months, and that's when I found out how many homeless that we have in Illinois alone. So we're doing our small part to help.
Homeless veterans and getting rid of Asian carp. Betty DeFord is the founder of the original Redneck Fishing Tournament, which is this weekend in Bath, Illinois. Betty, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you so very much. Come on down. It's fun.
Thanks, Betty. There's some great videos of how this happens. Betty did a great job of describing it. But if you follow 21st Show, we'll tweet out a couple of those. National Geographic channel was down there filming a whole special about this. So they've got a lot on there. You know, lawmakers have struggled with how to get rid of Asian carp. And one thing they thought might help would be reintroducing the prehistoric alligator gar back into Illinois waters. This past session, they passed a resolution to do so. It was led by Chicago area Republican Michael Zaleski, who kindly is making some time for us in the middle of his family vacation. Representative Zaleski, thanks for joining us this morning. I know you had originally introduced the bill to reintroduce alligator gar, and I want to ask you about that and its relation to Asian carp, because the Department of Natural Resources has said alligator gar isn't really going to do anything to help Asian carp.
Yeah, they're skeptical, for sure. I think when we introduced it, it was actually a resolution. So what we try to do when we have an agency like DNR is, instead of doing a bill to sort of mandate it, we start off with a resolution strongly encouraging an agency to do that. And that's what we did this year. We passed a resolution encouraging DNR to repopulate the waterways with alligator gar. I would say at the time, no one really expressed an opinion in one way or the other than the environmental groups, that this would have a good, solid effect. So, DNR is filled with conservation experts, so I'm also certainly willing to listen to their expertise. I do think, though, that my limited understanding of the biology of this is the alligator gar are going to try to feed on some of those Asian carp eggs. It might not be the cure to the problem. It's certainly not going to, certainly going to help mitigate the problem.
And so was that your motivation for introducing the resolution, was something to solve Asian carp, or was it also just because this was a prehistoric, I guess, I don't know if indigenous is the right word, fish to Illinois, and you just wanted to bring it back?
An ugly indigenous fish. It was Asian carp centric for sure. The Environmental Law and Policy Center, along with Environment Illinois, which is the umbrella organization for environmental groups that lobby the General Assembly, they were the ones that came to me with the resolution. They were the ones that offered their subject matter expertise that seemed to suggest that this was going to have a help, that this was going to help with Asian carp. So, you know, you take them at their word that, you know, if we're always looking for holistic ways to deal with this problem, this is just one of many ways we can try to mitigate the Asian carp population in the state. I think it's certainly more appealing than what we've been doing otherwise, which is electrocuting them in the rivers and trying to do these workarounds, which, you know, aren't necessarily as appealing as introducing natural predators to Asian carp and trying to do it that way.
Thanks. Representative Michael Zaleski is an Illinois Republican who represents Illinois' 23rd district in Cook and DuPage County. When we come back, we've got to take a break. We're going to actually speak to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and to their chief of fisheries about Asian carp and alligator gar. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the invasive fish species Asian carp. Was actually reintroduced accidentally into waters in the 1970s and has been made a jump from the Mississippi into the Illinois River. There's obviously concern about preventing the Asian carp from getting into Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes. That's what we've been talking about, whether it's the folks in Bath, Illinois, who are trying to fish them out of the water, or as we were just hearing from Representative Michael Zaleski, a new provision or to have a resolution to have the prehistoric alligator gar back reintroduced into Illinois waters. I want to bring the Illinois Department of Natural Resources into the conversation. Dan Stevenson is the chief of fisheries for DNR. Dan, thanks for being with us. Welcome to the 21st.
Sure. Glad to be here.
You know, as you just heard Representative Zaleski saying that he led this bill to reintroduce alligator gar into Illinois in order, he's saying it may help eliminate Asian carp. He said you all are skeptical. What's the DNR's position on whether or not the alligator gar will actually help lower or eliminate the Asian carp population in Illinois waters?
Well, in short, let me back up just a little bit. We actually began the alligator gar reintroductions in 2010. We'd started that before this resolution came out. We stocked some in southern Illinois waters. They're actually native to the waters in southern Illinois, and then a little ways up the Illinois River, and we've stocked up as far north as Peoria. We've stocked some in there. Now, as so far as our position, it kind of just comes down to a numbers game. Well, first thing, I checked in our strategic plan, the division's strategic plan. We have 44,000 miles of rivers and streams in the state of Illinois. And we've got Asian carp in every one of those river miles, just about. There's a few that they haven't got upstream of Carlisle Lake yet. But most of them, we've got, when we talk about these Asian carp, we talk in terms of tons of fish per river mile. So, you know, it's just incredible the amount of Asian carp that are out there. And we're stocking a few thousand alligator gar per year in certain selected areas where it's suitable habitat. They were native here up until about 50 years ago. The last documented fish was caught in southern Illinois, and since they were officially declared extirpated in 1994 by the Endangered Species Board, so they've been gone for about 50 years, and we're trying to bring them back. And we're bringing them back to increase biodiversity. They're the top. They're an apex predator, and we have an opportunity. Bring back a fish that was a prehistoric fish that was native to this state years ago. And another thing, too, is they'll make a very strong, large trophy sport fish, too. So those were really the reasons we were looking at bringing them back. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much as Asian carp. As I said, there's just no way they can get a handle on the Asian carp population. There's just tons and tons and tons.
Well, and this is also the difficulty, right, when you have an invasive species in terms of predators. There's not necessarily a way to reintroduce a predator to control the population, is there?
That's right. Yeah, you know, if we did that, we could talk about muskies and other sport fish too that might help, but they just won't make a dent in it. There's just so many Asian carp, and as earlier Betty said from Bath, they spawn up to three times. I don't know if they've ever spawned four times a year, but they can spawn three times a year. And so, just their spawning potential, reproductive potential is so great. Stocking a handful of alligator gar in selected spots on rivers and streams up downstate won't have much.
Dan, I do want to get to the alligator gar and talk a little bit more about it, but mm-hmm. maybe I just want to ask you about what is being done to control the Asian carp population in Illinois, what kind of things the DNR is working on?
Yeah. Well, first, we've got through a US EPA grant, we've got some research going on with various universities, Western, Eastern, Southern, U of I. So they're doing some research on reproduction and where the fish are located. But the main work we're doing is we've contracted with commercial fishermen. They're really, really good fishermen. They set nets. They know how to do it. And they really can take out a lot of fish in a hurry. And if you go upstream of Starved Rock on the Illinois River and go from there up to about I-55 bridge, they've been working in there. Well, actually, they've worked all the way to Lake Michigan. We have them working up above the electric barriers as well. But collecting fish, taking out fish, and from the Morris or the I-55 bridge, let's say, to Starved Rock, we've taken out nearly 5 million pounds of fish sent them to Schaefer's, again, where Betty mentioned she sends them.
For and they fertilizer.
Turn into mm-hmm. fertilizer. Yeah. So we're trying to slow down the migration, and we are actually slowing down the migration of the leading edge up the Illinois River, because that's the big threat getting into Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes.
Why is it so important to keep Asian carp from getting into Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes?
The concern is, as we mentioned before, the reproductive potential. They reproduce, they spawn a lot. Now, they do need rivers to spawn in, so they would not spawn in Lake Michigan. The problem is, if they get into Lake Michigan, they can work their way around to other rivers and streams that empty into Lake Michigan from the state of Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, and get into those rivers and streams and cause the same kind of damage in those, and then on up into Lake Superior and up into Canada. So if they get into there, it's like just the foothold. They've got a foothold into the whole Great Lakes system. So we want to keep them out of there because they could do the same damage in those other states as they are in Illinois, Indiana. Well, the whole Mississippi, Ohio rivers, and Missouri River watersheds.
Right, because it started within the Mississippi Basin, spread to the Ohio and then Illinois rivers, right?
Exactly.
I wanted to ask you about this electric fence. We heard Representative Zaleski talking about the fish getting electrified. I know that in 2013, there was some research from the Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service showing that some small fish have been able to get through the electric barrier. I know in the past there's been other folks like the NRDC that said that this doesn't necessarily have the best track record. Are you saying that you guys are relying more on those fishermen than the barriers, or how are you all trying to tackle this?
Good question. It's a combination. Now, they did some research, yes, that showed that fish can get entrapped in small ones and flow through the electric barrier on in barges. They used minnows. They did not use actual Asian carp, and no Asian carp to date have gone through that way. We have collected only one Asian carp ever above the electric barrier, and that was in 2010 in Lake Calumet, and that actually came in from a stocking rather than coming upstream and making it through the electric barrier. You know, just because they found out in 2013 that they could actually ride through in the, between the barges, or kind of get pulled through between the barges, well, they haven't, and they've been able to do that since the beginning of time, since they first got in there. They just never have. And so, yes, they can do it, but they haven't yet. So, and that, and we're actually, as we said, slowing down the leading edge. If you look at the electric barriers, they're in what's called Lockport Pool, and we have no Asian carp in Lockport Pool. This is all part of our sampling using the commercial fishermen and our biology.
Yeah, how do you do that? How do you do that sampling?
Nets, a lot of nets, miles and miles. I can't tell you how many hundreds and or actually thousands of miles of nets we've set over the last 5 years. And we have electrofishing, and I don't have the numbers of hours of electrofishing we've done. We find none in Lockport Pool. We find, haven't found any in 4 years in Brandon Road Pool, and only a handful downstream in Dresden Island Pool. That's the next one downstream. So right now, we don't even have any threats by Asian carp to the electric barrier. There are a couple of pools downstream still. So we're hoping, and actually we've seen in Dresden Island Pool, since 2012, we've seen a 68% reduction in the number of Asian carp in Dresden Island Pool. So we feel good about using the commercial fishermen and our biologists to take them out and stopping that leading edge, maybe not stopping it, but slowing it. And we can say actually now that the leading edge of the migration of the Illinois River hasn't moved upstream in 10 years.
In 10 years, okay.
Yeah, so we're really pleased about that. And that doesn't mean we're going to slack off in our diligence or anything like that. We'll be vigilant in maintaining that. And matter of fact, we got crews out right now. So,
and have has DNR been affected by the stage budget impasse and budget cuts? Has that had an effect on what you all have done over the past year in terms of your efforts for combating Asian carp?
No, it has. And we've had other issues on other parts, you know, stocking and other sport fish management mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. We've had other problems due to the budget impasse. But the money that we use for Asian carp is actually 100% funded through a US EPA grant. So that just keeps coming, and we keep utilizing that. That has not slowed down. The budget impasse had nothing to do with that. So we were really lucky in that sense.
Let's talk about the alligator gar for a minute. Can you tell us this is a prehistoric fish? What does it look like?
Well, they're a long, cylindrical-shaped fish. They do get big. You've probably seen pictures of them.
They seem very large, but larger than Asian carp, even.
Yes. But even at that, they have what's called they have a relatively small gape, and gape is their throat, mouth size, and all that. So and Asian carp grow so quickly that Asian carp, say the hatch went out in May, they'll get up to 2 or 3 4-inch fingerling. An alligator carp gar could take them up to that size, but within 3 months, they're too big even for a large alligator gar to take. So by the end of the first year, the Asian carp are too big. And as we said, too, it's just a numbers game. You know, if you got a few thousand alligator gar and
there's not enough eggs for them to eat. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And for all of these, for alligator gar, for Asian carp, can you just remind us, since we've got you on the line, about fishing licenses and what people need to be doing to make sure they're doing stuff legally in the state?
Yeah, anytime you take fish, you need to have a sport fish license. There are commercial fishing licenses, too, for those commercial fishermen that set nets and then sell them to the market and all that. But just for any kind of fishing you do, if you're 16 years old or older, you have to have a fishing license. And that's really – I had somebody ask me not too long ago. They said, well, what can we do to help with the reintroduction of the alligator gar? And really, the only money we get is from fishing license sales. So there's no special fund you can send to the DNR and have it go to alligator gar. It's just all fishing license sales. That's where we get our money.
Dan Stevenson is the chief of fisheries for the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks. It was fun.
For most kids, live music is something they can't experience until they're over 21. And while many turn to youth music programs in their schools or communities, some are finding ways to organize themselves. That DIY mentality is one of the driving forces behind the Black Sheep Cafe in Springfield. This Saturday, the venue hosts Black Sheep Fest. It's an all-day punk music festival that brings 15 bands from Central Illinois. And we're joined now by Brian Galecki. He's one of the co-owners of Black Sheep Cafe. Hey, Brian, thanks for being with us on the 21st. What kind of bands are you going to have this Saturday at Black Sheep Fest?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
We have 15 bands, actually, this Black Sheep Fest. They're just all local. I would say it's a pretty wide variety of genres that are going to be playing. Wide variety of genres and also age groups, too. You have, like, kids playing in high school playing in bands, and then also older musicians maybe in their 40s playing as well.
Yeah, so that's a pretty unusual. That's probably pretty unusual to have a festival with an age range from like teenagers. It's a couple decades. Why is it important for you to have that age diversity at Black Sheep Fest?
Right. Well, we are an all ages venue, of course, and some take that to be some just pass it off as a venue for kids or whatever. But we take the all ages term pretty seriously and really do try to reach out to people of all ages and kind of build a community here, especially those who are older. We always want to recognize, especially with a festival focused on local music in Springfield, we try to draw some that have been playing in bands for decades here. You know, like the band Epsom is playing Black Sheep Fest, one of the older ones, and the vocalist of that band, Scott Fangold, has been active in the music scene here since the early 90s and before that even. So we feel it's pretty important to kind of give those people a platform, as well as the high school students and college-age kids, I would say.
Well, and Brian, in addition to, as you're saying, recognizing the people who've been around for a while, you guys also give out a lot of different types of awards to encourage kids to keep making music. How do you do that?
I guess so. We just had our Battle of the Bands. I guess that was one way we would give out awards, I would say. And one of the awards for Battle of the Bands was a spot on Black Sheep Fest. So we have one band called Stems that are playing as a result of that. We had our Battle of the Bands back in beginning of July, and with that we usually have two winners, one to play Black Sheep Fest and then another that gets free recording time. Years past, we've had a studio right next door to us that's kind of worked with us, which unfortunately we don't have this year, but we do have a friend and helper who's been working on recording music, so he's going to be recording a demo for one of those bands inside Black Sheep. Probably in the next coming months.
Hey, Brian, we're almost out of time, but really quickly, how can a young person who wants to get involved in their local arts communities, what do you think they should do?
As far as like any city in general outside of Springfield?
Or even in Springfield, other than come to Black Sheep Fest.
Right. Obviously, I think the first step is just becoming as active as possible and recognizing what's already out there. You know, I always tell bands that are like, looking to get on shows, like, and asking us if there's anything they can play, just come out, you know, and make those connections. And really, it's a lot easier to become involved if you're out there and doing things, you know. And at Black Sheep, we try to make that as open of a community as possible to give anybody a chance that wants to get involved a chance.
Yeah, so they can come out this weekend to Black Sheep Fest on Saturday in Springfield at the Black Sheep Cafe. Their co-owner, Brian Galecki, is with us. Hey, Brian, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
We'll tweet out all that information if you follow 21st Show. That's all the time we have for today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to the 21st.